Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.
So talk to your people like you would talk to someone at your pay grade or your responsibility level. Treat them like a human being, like an equal, and you will be shocked at how much better they perform.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for being here today. You are today going to get some pillars of company culture, not just any company culture, but specifically a company culture that's going to improve productivity, performance, and profits. And our guest today is an expert in those things. Chris Dyer is a recognized company culture and remote work expert. As a former CEO managing thousands of people, and yes, responsible for that company culture, his companies consistently were named a best place to work. Those companies also have been named fastest growing company by Inc. magazine 5 times. And Chris is an author of 3 best-selling books, and we're going to be talking about one of those today, called The Power of Company Culture, How Any Business Can Build a Culture That Improves Productivity, Performance, and Profits. That's a lot of P's. Chris, you've been named like on so many of these top 50 lists, top 40, top 50, top 101, top 50, HR leaders, global thought leaders, voice in leadership, podcasts, change management gurus. You got a lot of lists there.
Yeah, I don't know how, maybe my bribes are working well. I don't know, but I'm happy. I love to put out good content. I love to help people. And I think, you know, you get a little reward here or there when someone throws you on a list. So I'm super excited to be here, David. I know we've had the opportunity to talk before and you've been on my podcast before. So I'm excited to hopefully maybe give somebody who's listening some little bit of wisdom, something they can take back to make their life better, their workplace better, their teams better, that I had to go through, that I had to learn, you know, along the way in my journey.
I have no doubt. Absolutely. And that is why you're on all those lists, because the value you're providing. So we're going to get into culture and all that's in your book and so forth. But before we do that, just so we can learn a little bit more about you for those listeners who don't know you yet, can you take us back to one of your earliest memories of yourself as a leader?
Earliest as a leader? Yeah. You know, it was probably in kindergarten. When I was trying to convince a group of kids to basically convince this other group of kids to give them this thing we found in the sand so that then we could take over this part of the playground. I remember like organizing a group to convince this other group to do something, because ultimately what I wanted was to go on, you know, the swings or whatever they were. And I picked up on that. We had something. We found this like little, like, oh, it was like a cover to a drain pipe or something. And like a couple of other kids thought that was cool and they wanted to see it. And then we were like, well, how do we turn this into an advantage? Like, I remember, like, I think now, like, how was I thinking that way in kindergarten? Like, to, you know, and I knew I was somehow, I don't want to say smart enough, I was devious enough to realize I needed to get the group, one group, to convince the other group, not me to be the one to convince them to do it. And at some level, I think that's what leaders are doing every day, is how do you get a group of people on board with your vision and ultimately get them to go out there and try to make that happen?
Schoolyard economics are funny things. It's like, what are the currency? Well, it's a drain pipe cover.
That's right.
Oh, I love it. All right. Well, with that early, that's a pretty early memory. Kindergarten, that's taking it back a piece. I recognize the dynamics sometimes. I don't think I was good at getting the group at that point in my life to actually take action. So kudos. All right, so we're talking about the power of company culture, how any business can build a culture that improves productivity, performance, and profits. So, you know, culture is one of those words bandied about. You're an expert on culture. This book is its second edition, talking about the power of company culture. And it's one of those words that gets thrown around, and I think sometimes even loses meaning because it's just used so often. So ground us. Let's get started foundationally. What are you talking about when you're talking about culture?
Culture is the seen and unseen things that go into how do we get something done at work or at home or in your church or in your volunteer organization or whatever. When you're working with at least one other person, what are the things that happen or don't happen in that scenario to get something done? And so that's a really important thing to understand. I'm not talking about this BS version of culture that's some artistically creative thing that's like nefarious and out there and like we need to somehow, you know, only this one special person can create it. No, no, no. I'm talking about the science of this. And so there are very specific things we can do to create very specific outcomes. And so if you're like, hey, I'm in a company, I want to get stuff done, and I notice that it takes us a long time to get things done, that's a cultural phenomenon. Or I notice that we jump on big ideas, we move quick, but we never quite finish the idea. Nothing ever really gets finished and done. That's a cultural norm. I notice that when something doesn't go right, my boss yells and screams and blames and someone gets fired or demoted or in trouble. Like, that's culture. So there's always something that we're trying to deal with, fix, or maybe want to amplify. Maybe it's a good thing we want to do more of. And so how do we understand that? That's ultimately what culture is. And whether you've heard 1,500 speakers say that word and you're like, yeah, I've heard it enough, like, I get it, but like, it's still the thing you have to deal with every day, right? It's still something we have to figure out and fix and use and catapult and, I don't know, energize in a way that can work for us in our workplaces.
All right, so if that's what culture is, it's like how we do things around here and how things get done and all those different aspects, all those different facets. And I think you hinted at this when you're talking about one other person. I'm curious about what you consider the smallest unit of culture. And I ask because, you know, we've got folks listening to this show who are maybe leading a team of two or three other people or who are more project managers. We also have CEOs who have that corporate responsibility for their whole organization. So from your perspective, what's the smallest unit in which we experience culture and can start influencing it?
I think it's one person. So, I mean, I could take famous psychologist Adler, who famously said, all problems are interpersonal problems. Every problem we have is because of another person. So if we were on this earth or in this universe all by ourselves, we would have no problems. Literally nothing would bother us. We didn't take a shower. I mean, there's no one there to smell you. You need food, you go pick it off the tree. I mean, like, you know, everything that happens is because of another person. So I think one person is that minimum viable, you know, culture. Because otherwise, I'll just do whatever I want. There is no culture. I just do how I do things is how I do things if I was by myself. So one person. Now, that's not a very strong bond. It's a bond and it's correct. But like, where do we really see real culture happening? And that's probably 5 to 7 people. So if we look at anthropology, 5 to 7 sort of makes a group that can rely on each other, that can get things done, right? And then we start seeing subsets into 25, 50, and 150. And 150, we know that's too big. And that's when people start breaking off and they go start creating their own subcultures, or back in the day, their own, you know, little towns or own little areas. So there's kind of these little magic numbers that are really important to help us navigate all of that.
Interesting. And it might be generous. I'm pretty sure if I were completely by myself, I'd still have problems with myself. that's a whole different podcast. That's a different episode. All right. So when we're talking about creating a successful culture, you've got seven pillars that you recommend. But before we dive into the specific pillars, what is it how do we need to be thinking about culture before we start getting into the how? What is it that we need to be thinking about in terms of the why and the what and the unseen things that often people don't think about when it comes to considering culture?
So a few things. One is that we need, as I mentioned before, we need to understand that culture is a science. This is a very specific thing happening. This is not ping pong tables and bean bags and, you know, I don't know, beer Fridays. Those are cool things you can do, but that's not culture. Culture are these seven things that we'll talk about in a second. As a foundational thing, I mean, I really believe that mastery and autonomy and purpose are really big things. We've heard, you know, some other people have kind of backed me up on this. I mean, Daniel Pink's a big one in that. People have to have a certain amount of autonomy to get their job done, right? We micromanage people, they're not going to do a good job. If we hire people who aren't tied to our purpose, who don't want to do the thing that we're ultimately doing as a company, like, that's not going to work. And if we don't allow people the opportunity to learn new things and to get better, I mean, this is like some weird thing that differentiates us from the rest of the planet as a species. And there are lots of things, but this is one that's really interesting of like, we're always trying to get better. And there are other animals that have a pretty high level of ability to use tools and do different things, but like to get better, be like not satisfied with what I have, like I need to learn more, I need to read this book, I need to, how do you do that thing? Like that's a really unique part of our existence as humans. And yet at work, like I can't tell you how many times clients have brought me in and they're like, oh, my people aren't happy, we keep losing people. And it's like, well, they're doing the same stupid job over and over and over again. You give them no opportunity to learn anything and you keep all the information away from them. So like they're in a vacuum just trying to get a job done. So we have to really understand those kind of core principles in the beginning. And like, you got to have value statements and customer service statements, and you got to figure out what your purpose is and know what you're trying to do. And you understand what your why is, if we want to steal from Simon Sinek. That's all going to be figured out here before you can jump to how do I have a high performing culture, right? Those things have to be there, and then we can jump to that.
Yeah. You know, I was talking with a performance coach a couple weeks ago, a colleague, and he was asking my perspective on an organization he's working with, and they were concerned, they really want to have a development culture, they're constantly improving, growing, building, so forth. And they were concerned about the people who don't want to do that. And, you know, as we talked, I kept coming back to similar to what you were saying is like, it's human nature. It's, if there's something getting in the way of that, that might be dampening it, that's to me where I want to look. But I mean, just about everybody has some aspect of curiosity, some way in which they're, you know, grow, and but we stamp it out, don't we?
Yeah. And what's interesting about what you said is a lot of times what I see is it's not that people don't want to learn and get better. It's that they don't necessarily want to be promoted. Maybe they don't want to be a leader. Maybe they're very happy in the job that they're in. They're very happy. And where they are in their life, they've got kids and a spouse, or maybe they don't have kids and a spouse, or like whatever it is they're in their life. And they're like, listen, this job that I'm doing is perfect for me right now, with where I am. Don't try to make me something I don't want to be yet.
Yeah.
And we think like, oh, well, don't you want to be the CEO one day? Well, like everybody can't be the CEO one day. That's a stupid like thought process. So, Can we look for people that maybe do want to be that? Sure, but not everyone can do that. So we have to decide, do they not want to get better, or are they just trying not to like be shoved into some other role or responsibility that they don't really want yet?
Yeah, there's so many ways to grow and improve and get better. And you know, to just pigeonhole that into one thing doesn't serve them or you. So, all right, well, so that, and that's an aside, but I think it's important. I just wanted to capitalize on it since you brought it up. So let's get into practically now how we start to build, a culture, a successful culture. Specifically, you're talking about a culture that improves productivity, performance, and profits. So we're not just talking about any culture, and I think that's important to distinguish here. You're talking about a culture that specifically is going to improve productivity, performance, and profits. You can have other kinds of cultures, right?
Yeah, and I would really put that into what is a high-performing culture. Now, there's a lots of different cultures. You can have a family type culture, you can have a high intensity culture, you can have all these different things. But so I'm not advocating that you have to go be Amazon or you have to go be Google or Facebook or Apple. I'm not saying you have to be one of these very specific cultures, but we do see commonalities amongst, no matter how they interpret culture. It's sort of like, listen, you go to your, when you're a kid, you go to your friend's house and you notice their parents handle things differently, right? And you might go to another friend's house and they act very differently. Like the culture in the house is very different than yours. And yet all of your friends graduated from high school and went on to college and were successful. And like the end was still the same. And what the parents ultimately cared about was the same. They had a very different way of parenting and doing it, and that's okay. And so it's the same thing with cultures. But what we want is for them to really attack this in the right way. And so I always say the first thing that they need to do is to start being far more transparent. And that's my first pillar, and it's my first pillar for a reason, is that that's sort of like turning the lights on. You know, as leaders, we can complain no one has any good ideas and my people aren't motivated or they're not engaged or they're not, you know, fill in the blank. And you're like, yeah, because they're in the dark. You've literally asked them to go sit in a room, in solitary confinement and go do a job. Turn on the lights and show them what you know, why this is happening, how we made this decision. What are we thinking about doing later on? Where is the company headed? Why did we fail over here when we tried this thing? And magically, it's not actually magic, it's actually just common sense, but it feels like magic that all of a sudden people start caring and they start having better ideas and they start coming to you with things that you never thought about before because people are amazing and they have incredible creativity and analytical abilities, and they look at all this stuff and they come back and say, I noticed we're doing this thing. Why? What? Do you know we can combine these two things and save like a gazillion dollars for the company? And you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. I mean, I had this stuff happen to me all the time. As soon as I turned the lights on, my people started being rock stars.
Yeah. It's, you know, we see that so often. Why are my people not thinking strategically? Well, have you given them the information with which to think strategically? And, yeah, you know, and so to create that ownership. So you rank transparency as your first pillar. You say in the book, because it lies at the heart of every positive transaction between employees, customers, staff, vendors, et cetera. And so you just very eloquently explained why it's so important, what it does for us. So how do we start to increase transparency on our teams? It can, and maybe a converse question of this is, what keeps us from it? Because I think it's one of those things that even some organizations like have good intentions, and some leaders like, okay, I do want to be transparent, but there's pitfalls and there's ways that we bind ourselves up sometimes because there's also stuff we can't be transparent about. So what gets in the way? How do we actually increase it?
Yeah. So the simple answer could be, go back and ask your team, what do you wish you knew more about? What is it you don't know that you wish you knew? I mean, you can ask them, but that's going to be a little limiting because sometimes they don't know what they don't know. But at least asking that question will start to surface some of the really easy, kind of low-hanging fruit. When someone says, well, I wish I knew this. And you're like, oh, I didn't know you didn't even know that. Here, I can give you all that information. But the ones that I suggest that companies think about, does everyone on every team know each other's goals? I can't tell you how many clients I work with. I go in and work with a team and I go, okay, do you all know each other's goals? And they're like, no. Like it's some super secret thing that only them and their boss knows. And I'm like, this doesn't make sense to me. If we all knew each other's goals, we could help each other. We could also make sure that our goals aren't conflicting with each other as well, which creates a lot of toxic cultural behavior.
Yep.
But if I know that your goal is to reach 1 million in sales this year, and my goal is to reach 1 million in sales, and like, how do I help you too? Or if maybe my goal is like high customer satisfaction and your goal is 1 million in sales. Well, those two things need to work together because maybe if the clients aren't happy, we're not gonna be able to reach that sales goal that we're after. So that's a really easy way. Does your team know your goals as a manager? Because how do they help you as the leader shine and do well and ultimately help them if you don't reach your goals? You know, a leader not reaching their goals is gonna be getting micromanaged, gonna get pounded from the top. And then that's, you know, crap rolls downhill and it's going to end up to that team. We used to share financials. I'm a big advocate for sharing as much financial data as possible. Mm-hmm. We used to give everyone our P&L, and then we would deep dive on like where we were making our money and where we were spending our money. You know, there may be reasons why you can't share certain things in different companies, but like I would give every department like the detailed expenses for their department. And so as a large level, we would say, here's the P&L, here's how we do it, get their thoughts. And then each team, it was like, okay, operations team, here's all your operational expenses at a detailed level. And they always came back with ideas. Always came back and said, did you know we could do this? Did you know we could save money with this way? I noticed, why are we spending so much money over here? Like, that doesn't seem important. They would push and pull, and they wanted to help. And then we set a goal. Let's try to save 5% this year. And every year we would blow it out of the water. So that's such a fantastic way of giving information. Now, other simple things could be, hey, we lost somebody, and showing up at a company-wide meeting and saying, hey, we lost Tom, and this is why we lost Tom. Being open and honest about it. Or, hey, we're thinking about hiring. We just hired Jane. This is why we hired Jane. These are the exact reasons why. This is, you know, what we were thinking, what we were hoping she's going to do. She starts on Monday. Like, sharing all of that information. There's a lot of times we hide behind mistakes. We hide behind things when people leave our company. We hide when we don't land that big deal. We hide when we lose a big client. That's when we got to show up and tell people what's going on so they can help us the next time.
So what is it that keeps, with all these benefits for transparency, which I completely agree with, sharing the finance, like, does everybody in your business know how you make money? I mean, it's funny how often even that level of fundamental information is not clear to people. But so what is it that that causes the hiding, that causes us, from a leadership perspective, in the self-coaching perspective, what should we be paying attention to that can trip us up and keep us from being as transparent as we could be if we're not making ourselves aware of that?
Leaders have this misguided notion they have to be perfect or look perfect or make all the right decisions all the time. And always the best leaders I knew were the ones who listened the most, were willing to admit they made a mistake, who are open and honest about what the decision they made, and if it didn't work out, then how can we do better next time? Those were always the best leaders. And they were also the same people that pointed out to us when things went right, when we did do something well. Hey, everyone, when we landed this client, and I think it was really these two or three things that we did that really made the difference. So they're calling out in a transparent way what worked as well, and not showing up and saying, I, the mighty leader, was the one who got this Coca-Cola signed with us, and it's all because of me, and then taking the credit of all the people. No, instead of saying, hey, I noticed that this salesperson really did a great job early on developing these relationships. The onboarding team did this. The IT team fixed this thing for them. So we didn't have any IT issues. Like, really talking about what worked and highlighting, those parts. I forget what book it was, but they talked about how the best teams in like college football, it was either college football or college basketball, I think it was football, they said that did the best, they went back and studied what they did in film sessions. And the best teams did one thing and the worst teams did another. So the worst teams showed tape to their team and showed them what they did wrong on a consistent basis. And the best teams went and showed them more times than not how they did the play correctly. So they broke down the play and said, do you see how you blocked this person here? Do you see how you ran over there? Do you see how you looked and then you threw the ball that way? Like, whatever the thing was, that's how you do it correctly. Remember that those teams did better than when we said, hey, that you missed the block there, you missed the pass, you should have done this, right? Because that just puts people in a constant like decision-making framework of being fearful, of like second guessing themselves all the time, instead of like, I know what it's right. I know what it's like to do it right. I'm going to keep trying to do it right. Even if it's not right every time, I know what right looks like. And I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep experimenting. I'm going to keep putting my, take a risk and go out there and do it, because I know that my leaders value that hard work and me trying to do it the right way.
You know, and just practically, any kind of after action review, post project celebration, any of that, are we asking ourselves and our teams, are we as together, are we asking, what did we do right? What did we get right? Maybe even what went right that we weren't expecting and that we can learn from, all of those positives that give us that mental picture of what success looks like so we can keep aiming at it.
That's this positivity pillar. That's my second pillar, positivity. We just kind of slid right into is what's working. Focusing on what's working first, looking for those little bits of data. It's called positive dissidence. Like what's working in the sea of chaos that's not working, right? That's really, really important that we think about that as leaders. What's working? We have to deal with what's not working. We still have to talk about how do we get better? How do we improve here? How do we, do better next time? But we should start with what did you do right when you did the thing, not what did you do wrong?
Let's do that again. A friend of mine is talking about a leader he had who started every week with, tell me about your blueberries. And the story was the guy said, if you take us back to like our hunter-gatherer days and somebody comes back with a handful of blueberries, you're not asking them about anything else except, hey, how'd you get those blueberries? Tell me about your success there and let's build on that, right?
Where did you find the blueberries? How do I get it? Not where did you go that you didn't find them? Like, just tell me what the success is. Yeah.
I love that as a metaphor. All right, our guest today, Chris Dyer. The book is The Power of Company Culture, How Any Business Can Build a Culture That Improves Productivity, Performance, and Profits. We've been talking about the first couple pillars of cultural success, so transparency, positivity, and pillar number three, which I honestly did not expect to see as the third pillar of culture, but it makes all the sense in the world, measurement. Maybe not the first thing that you think about when you're thinking about culture, but it's so vital. So why is measurement the third pillar?
Yeah, and although I would say transparency is like pillar number one, is the thing you got to do first. The rest of them, like you can kind of decide what you think your company's sucking at and you can really go and then decide to go put focus on that. But measurement is really important to me because what I noticed is that some of the best companies in the world know how to measure what matters really, really well. Google is probably the best example of this. I mean, they measure what they measure. They're constantly measuring what matters to them. I mean, they measured what made a great team and they measure, obviously their analytics and then all the things they do online. But if it matters to you, you should be measuring it. And people can say, well, maybe that's too big for them, measuring analytics and, marketing data or like operational data. Like on a really simple level, if you want people on your team who say thank you, who focus on the positive, who are willing to share their mistakes, who are, whatever the thing is you wish, if you make a really big deal out of that, if you're like, hey, Tom, thank you so much. And Jane, thank you so much for, doing this thing. It really makes a big difference. I saw that the team this week had thanked each other 26 times. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You're measuring it. You know what happened. And then you're talking about it. You will get more of that behavior. So if we're not measuring it and we're not acknowledging and we're not talking about it, we can't possibly expect that behavior to continue or get even to amplify. And sometimes we just think like, well, this one team I was on was really great. They did all these great things and I came out of this team and they didn't do them. And sometimes that's because we didn't show them this is what we expect. Because I can walk into any team and I guarantee I can make that team better. Now, are there some bad apples? It's always possible there are bad apples you have to get rid of that don't want to change. But most of the time, it's a bad cultural mix and they don't know what's expected of them and they don't understand why people want them to do these things or the company wants them to do these things. And so if we just measure it and we talk about it, it's important. Now, the second part of measurement is I'm a big believer in systems. So whether you're Scrum and Agile or Six Sigma or Kaizen or Lean or whatever makes sense for your business, having a common language and a system in place where we can talk about how to measure things and we know what we're going to focus on I mean, you talked about a kind of a post-mortem after you do a project that's a very scrum and agile thing, come together, what worked, what could we improve on? That's a methodology that's in their system. In lean, it's like really big to challenge, like day one, challenge what you think is wrong with what we're doing, like to get new and fresh perspectives in there. So measuring is important, but also having that system on top of that. So we're not just trying to like measure everything. I know a lot of companies are like, we'll measure 1,000 things and then it doesn't ever go anywhere. And that doesn't work either.
Yeah, that's the boil the ocean type thing. So when you're looking at values, like you just said, okay, if you have a value of gratitude, you can just actively count how many times it says thank you. But what are some other ways that you have seen or that you think about in terms of measurement when it comes to a specific value that might feel a little bit more hard to define, but that's still vitally important to the organization?
Well, I mean, the first thing is to identify. So what is it that's valuable to the organization? For us, it was always, we wanted people who are willing to do a 5-minute favor for somebody. We wanted people who said thank you. We wanted people who would bring us ideas. I wanted people that would challenge anybody. I would be willing to say, I don't think that's the right thing. I think there's a better way to do this, and here's why, and here's what I think. And then ultimately, like number five was, I wanted people that when we were done arguing and we were done with that meeting and we agreed that this was the way to go, that they would then flip the switch and say, okay, we've decided we're going to do this. I'm going to be totally behind this idea and go give it its best shot and not sabotage or drag my feet or be passive aggressive. And so those were like five things in my company and my teams that we thought were really important. And so we would call them out. We would talk about them. We would make sure that we rewarded people for that. I mean, if someone was going to come and ask me for a raise and I didn't think they were meeting what I wanted, I would talk about the things, those five things, not some economic number. Because I noticed if we were doing the things that were important to us, we were meeting our goals consistently.
Hmm. And so all of those are quantifiable in terms of, you can evaluate, you can measure, are these things happening?
Right.
But like you said, those were the five that were the most important at a personal behavioral level. You're not trying to look at 25 different metrics. You had five that you knew mattered.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I had other teams in my company, but they had totally different five things that they cared about. It might've been like super diligent, like, the kind of person that's going to like really double check their work and never make mistakes because they made a mistake. It was a really, really big deal. And so what they valued was a little different than maybe what I valued with the people I was working with on a consistent basis.
So the pillar that we're just talking about is measurement. And this started to even get into the next pillar, which is acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, acknowledgement takes many different forms, but you're to calling out the positive behaviors, calling out what you're seeing, you get more of what you celebrate and encourage. So acknowledgement, is there more to it than that kind of seeing publicly so that we're sharing the stories, we're shining a spotlight and celebrating what we need more of? Is there more to it, or is that really what we're talking about here?
So acknowledgement and recognition has a couple really key things that are important. Number one, those programs need to be bottom up, meaning the average employee should feel like they own that they have the ability to contribute to that in a meaningful way. When I give the story in the book about our green flag system we use in our Slack channel, it was not the responsibility of the manager to acknowledge somebody. They could, then that may happen, but everyone's not waiting around for their boss to notice them and then give them an award or something. This was, if I was on a team with you, David, and you did something great, even though you and I are teammates, I can go into that channel and be like, hey, he just killed it on this meeting. I mean, he made the client happy. Way to go. Good job. It's not like, oh, I tell my boss and then my boss is going to find some time to thank you like a week or two later when now it's kind of lost its thrill, right? It's, I see it. I'm going to say something. I'm going to call it out. And if by telling the whole company or telling everyone in my division or whatever, everyone else can jump in and be like, hey, great job. So they know you did a great job. You feel good. They also know that maybe there's something about your expertise, or maybe they might bring you in next time they have a client they really are a difficult person they need to deal with or whatever. Gives you that clout and exposure across the organization. And this really helps in like remote and hybrid environments as well, doing it this way, as opposed to we're all going to sit in a conference room together and wait for our boss to acknowledge us. Now, the second part is, and this is something I've kind of added to this that isn't necessarily in the book, so this is kind of a little extra credit for everybody, is that there is horizontal leadership and there's vertical leadership. And so I don't know if you've ever noticed like leaders who are really, really good at managing the people they have on their team. And then there are leaders who are really, really good at managing all the other people at their level, like all the other directors or all the other VPs. And maybe they're not so good. Like each person's not so good at the other thing. So they're really good at managing their team, but they're not so good at managing the politics and the people at their level. Or they're really great at their level, but they're not so good at managing their people.
Yeah.
And what you notice is the people who are really good at managing at their level, they get promoted. And everyone's like, how did that person get promoted? They are the worst boss. Their team hates them. But because they could manage their people at their level and they could manage up really well. The best people can do both. And if you are a vertical leader, if you're thinking about managing vertically, you also have to make sure that you are treating your people horizontally.
Yeah.
So what do I mean by that? If you go to someone and say, oh, what a good job you did on that project. I'm just so surprised that you were able to figure that out. That's condescending. You would never say that to a fellow VP or to your boss. You would say, thank you. You really helped me. Thank you so much for jumping in and doing that. So talk to your people like you would talk to someone at your pay grade or your responsibility level. Treat them like a human being, like an equal, and you will be shocked at how much better they perform. And so that's another big part of recognition, is that we're not treating them, we're not putting them in this like place of I'm better than you and I'm going to pat you on the head. Or I know more than you, and you know, and I'm just going to keep you kind of going along with my little tiny bits of praise that are kind of like maternal or paternal or whatever. You know, we want to remove that. We want to treat them like equals. Because I remember some of my best bosses were always people who just treated me on the like I was no different than them, and they were happy with the stuff that I did, and they were. If I got promoted above them, they would have given me a high five. Like they wanted the best for me. And this wasn't about power and control.
Yeah, there's a through line, but so much that you're saying in terms of leading for this kind of culture that requires a centeredness to the leader, is the word I'm going to use just from what I'm hearing. The centeredness that they can really truly have that attitude of gratitude because they're living in abundance. Not, I don't mean actual, like I've got money rolling out of my ears abundance, but like that I'm good and I have that good to offer other people. And I'm not coming from a place of I'm so hungry for power, prestige, recognition, whatever it is myself, that I can't give that to other people, that I'm going to be a conduit for that and all the good things that happen from that when we do it. So it's just as you've been talking, it's one of those elements. I just want to highlight, shine a light on that, because I think it's definitely an aspect of what you're talking about here, to lead this way.
Mm-hmm. And so what I find is that most of the leaders that don't lead this way, it's because they don't have the information. They haven't been taught how to do this. It's not that they're not capable. This is not a personality problem. It's that, you know, our parents, our coaches, our teachers pretty much manage us as a, you know, command and control, top down kind of a thing. And very few people have had the experience of being around a really great leader. Or were maybe conscious enough to even like let that sink in at whatever age they were to realize what was happening. And so that's what I love to do when I go in and help companies, is to teach the people this stuff, because you see this radical transformation in them. You see them really change and get better and get more centered, as you put it, because they now understand how to do it. And that's the, again, the difference between thinking about culture as an art versus a science.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the stuff you need to do. Go do it. Oh, you did it? And what happened? Oh, things got better? Cool. Want some more? Great. Here's some more. And then you just keep going and they get addicted to it. I mean, I got addicted to it as a leader of like, wow, I can just keep doing these cool things and keep trying these things and people get happier and they stay with my company longer and they do a better job and they need me less to save them, like, because they can do it themselves. Like, sign me up.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the elements that you were just describing a moment ago with regard to the vertical versus horizontal leadership, I just, again, want to pull that out, shine a light on it for listeners here, because it's one of those elements, like you said, the leaders are going to be most effective do both of those things. And so you commented on, hey, if you're doing the horizontal and you're getting to your peers, but you're not treating your folks the same way, we need to do that. And conversely, a lot of folks listening who really do focus on their teams, but maybe are neglecting that peer-to-peer, your colleagues, and such a straightforward, practical way that you're talking about to just acknowledge your peers, yeah, just to shine a light on them and go, wow, that was awesome. Thank you so much. And give that recognition in their group, in their peer group, and how often that's going to their manager, and how often that's going to make a difference for your relationships and your own career too.
Yeah. And we could probably flip this on its head and say, it's fear driving you in both of those scenarios, right? The leaders could be fearful of their team for whatever reason, thinking they don't know what they're doing, that they're going to pass them by, that whatever. Or you're fearful of the people at your level, that they're going to get the promotion over you, that they're going to tell you you're an idiot, you don't know what you're doing. And so if we can remove that fear and we can be happy for people and we can call them out and say, you did a great job, and not worry that it's going to reflect on us negatively, that because they did a good job, it doesn't mean someone's not going to notice when we do a good job. Like, we got to get rid of that fear. And in 90% of the time you can do that, it's going to work. There are those 10% of the cases where your culture is so bad, it doesn't matter. In that regard, I think it's time to leave. It's time to go find another job. But, you know, it should, in most cases, it should work if you can get rid of that fear and just be authentically happy for people, you're going to have a better outcome.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a better way to live. And from a leadership perspective, it's real leadership, because now you're being a positive influence in the culture generally, and you can bring people with you who want to do the same thing. And that's absolutely possible. And, like, you know, even in the, Chris, in this situation you're talking about, if you start doing that and it's such a caustic, critical culture where that's just not going to work, well, you haven't lost anything by doing that. Now you know. You know for sure, because you've taken the action, you run into the walls, you're like, okay, this is not a good place to be.
Yeah.
Now that's not guesswork anymore. Now it's data.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, talking with Chris Dyer, The Power of Company Culture is the book, How Any Business Can Build a Culture That Improves Productivity, Performance, and Profits. I'm talking about the 7 pillars of cultural success. We start with transparency. Then we've got positivity, measurement. We've been talking about acknowledgement. We're not going to have time to go through all 7 of these, Chris. So I'm going to ask you, I definitely want to get to the final one, mistakes. But before we do that, we've got what's left, uniqueness and listening. Well, maybe we can get to both of those. So I'm going to give you uniqueness and listening, and maybe give us the 50,000 foot view on these, and let's take it from there.
Yeah. So, I mean, listening is not, it's probably one that makes sense to everybody. In the book, I go into much deeper practical tips on how to be better listeners and the ways in which we can listen to our people in much more intentional ways. A quick example, like, ditch the annual survey, start doing a question a week with your team. Start asking them every week one question, something that you can hear from them, and then tell them what you heard and then go do something about it. You will find your people, your engagement levels go way up.
Just give us one quick example of a weekly question maybe that you've used or seen.
As your boss, how am I getting in your way?
Love right? It.
Or what, if you had a magic wand, like, what resource or what thing could I get for you that would help you do your job better? Or who on our team is killing it for you? Who in the company has, like, been a fantastic resource for you lately? Like, just, there's so many great ways. And if anybody wants a list, if you text my name, Chris, to 33777, I will send you a list of 25 starter questions that you can use right now for that. So,
everybody's scrambling for their phone or a pencil. Give us that text code one more time.
33777 and just type in Chris, C-H-R-I-S, and then it'll get you all in and I'll send you the information. So it's such a simple way to make sure people feel heard and to actually do something as a leader. I mean, I ask that question all the time. How am I as your CEO getting in your way? And every time I would solve all the problems, and then I asked them that again, like a month or two later, just convinced that they would not have anything new for me. They would always come back with something. And it was always like, you know, make decisions faster, or get us more resources. We really need to hire somebody over here. I mean, people would be honest and let me know what they needed. And I would be able to say, I heard you. This is what I heard. And this is what I'm going to do about it. And sometimes it would be like, we can't afford to hire anybody there right now. I'm really, really, really sorry. Like, maybe in 6 months we can, and this is why, and this is our budget, and this is, you know, and at least they felt heard, even if I couldn't do what they wanted. So that's the listening component.
We'll have to leave uniqueness for a moment. I want to drill down a little further on listening, because it's so critical. And yes, it makes sense to us. And what you just said is so important. So I want to get practical with that. You ask those kinds of questions. Sometimes you're going to hear things that go, oh, that makes all the sense in the world. Got it. Yeah, let me take care of that. Other times you're going to hear things that maybe you radically disagree with, or where they're misinformed, or you just can't do it for some reason. And I think it's so important when we're talking about listening. So A, you're actively going out, you're asking the question. It's not just passively waiting to hear something. You're going out and looking for it. But then secondly, how you're responding to that. So I want to just break down, do you have a way that you think about, you just gave us a couple of examples, do you have a way, that mental model that you use for how you respond to answers that you hear, particularly the ones that maybe make you wince a little bit, or that you feel like, I don't know that I can do that?
Again, transparency is key. So I would ask people questions, and for a period of time, I might tell them, listen, for the next month or the next 3 months or whatever, everything that you reply to, your answers are totally confidential. I will be the only one who reads them. I will be repeating the sentiment, but I will never send your answer to anybody. And you are encouraged to be anonymous if you want to be. And so I would ask tough questions. I would ask things like that, where they could feel like they could be honest and I didn't know who it was. You could guess and figure it out sometimes, but like, you know, that wasn't the point. Other times I would tell them, everything you reply is going to go back to everyone in the whole company. I'm going to share everyone's answers with everyone on purpose. And I'm going to ask very intentional questions there. Things like, who's really killing it for you? What could we be doing better? What have we not thought about from a sales perspective? Like, what are ideas? Can we get ideas going, right? And then because everyone knew their answers were going to be shared, they almost got a little competitive. They wanted to come up with a really great answer. And they wanted to be, you know, they knew everyone else was going to see each other's stuff. So, but we were transparent about it. So in both cases, if I got stuff I didn't like, I would still address it. A lot of you brought up this point, and it seems to me that you think this. Let me explain to you why it's really that. And let me tell you what we've done about it before. Let me tell you about what I'm thinking about now and how I might address it going forward, or maybe why I can't address it, or maybe there's a law in place that stops us from even doing that. And here, you just need a little bit of education. It can be annoying and frustrating and time consuming. And some leaders might be like, I ain't got time for that. But when we spend that time, it was only one question a week, and I would spend 30 minutes on it, 40 minutes on it a week. It just paid me back in gold over and over and over again. The ideas, my ability to catch poor thinking, to catch, you could feel almost like a little cancer building over here because like they were misinformed or they were getting antsy or frustrated, that I could go address it.
And wouldn't you rather know that up front and be able to before it metastasizes into this other thing? Yeah, for sure.
Exactly.
All right, Chris. Got one more pillar that I want to address, and we're running out of time. Before we do that, you already gave us the 33777 code. We're going to text Chris, get the list of those questions. Anywhere else, what else do you have for us? Where else should we go to get the book, connect with you, find out more?
Books on Amazon. I have it in regular, hardcover, softcover, and Audible. So I just finished, just launched the Audible version out there. So if anyone's interested, and I read it, you can find me there. You can find me, go to my website, chrisstar.com. Happy to connect with anybody on LinkedIn, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. I'm on with Twitter. I'm on all the things, on all the socials. So wherever you hang out, I'm there putting out content. Happy to engage with you there.
All right. Well, there you go. Opportunity to connect with Chris. Chris, the final pillar I want to talk about today, you already mentioned it earlier in our conversation a couple times, is mistakes. How you handle mistakes is vital to your culture. And you draw out, there's a distinction you make between errors and mistakes, which I also think is really important as we're talking about this. So over to you for errors, mistakes, and how we handle these.
Yeah, an error is I'm overworked, I'm undertrained, I'm multitasking, I came into work and I haven't slept in 3 days and I'm now a total mess and I'm just screwing up. That's errors, and we don't accept that. And people are going to get written up and fired or removed or whatever. Like, that stuff is not cool. Mistakes are very different, but often we end up treating people the same for both experiences. And that's where we get ourselves in trouble. Mistakes are, I tried something new and didn't work out. And I'm brave enough to come back to my boss or my team and say, hey, you know that thing we do all the time? I thought maybe I could make it a little bit better. And I tried this thing, and boy, was I wrong. That did not work. Don't ever try that. I mean, I screwed up. Or maybe I was working with this client and I had all the information I had. I checked with everyone I could. And this, based on what we knew at that moment, we made this decision. And then we later on found out it was wrong. And that's a mistake that we can not repeat again. But like, there was no way of me knowing I didn't have any more information. I couldn't possibly have known it was the wrong decision. I still want to celebrate and tell that person, thank you for being brave enough to make that choice. Thank you for being brave enough to come back and tell us so we can avoid that next time. And we don't keep making that expensive mistake over and over and over again. You know, because sometimes people just hide, not tell anybody, and the mistake keeps happening. Yeah. And the cost keeps happening, or you keep losing clients because of it. No one wants to raise their hand and go, it's because we keep screwing this thing up. So mistakes are really, really important. It's also where we find innovation. So sometimes people try things and it does work. I mean, in my book, I talk about the most famous. I think it's the most famous. It may not be the most impactful. I mean, penicillin was clearly an accident. That's probably the most impactful thing to like our lives, but the thing that most of us know, like we just think of penicillin now as like a standard, or you know, antibiotics. The one we know now is the post-it note. And I think the story of the post-it note, because you know, when they were penicillin, like they were trying to make something and they realized it was something else, whereas like someone was trying to make a really great glue and totally screwed up and made like the most terrible glue ever and then documented it, because 3M cares about mistakes and they document all of their experiments and what happened. And then some guy wanted a way to like hang up his little hymnal at choir practice and looked in their database to see if anyone else had ever made a really crappy glue. Boom. 30, 40 years before, someone had made a terrible glue that was perfect to put on back of paper that doesn't stick too much. It doesn't, you know, it can come off. And you have one of the greatest products ever created. You know, like 3M does a lot. They don't do more than all those things combined than they do for, I mean, during the pandemic, they probably sold more masks. But aside from that, post-it note is their number one thing. And it was a mistake that they valued, documented, kept record of, and took years, but actually ended up being able to turn in one of their most profitable products ever.
And it's taking a risk, and then what do we learn from that? And you know, the other thing that strikes me as you're talking about errors and mistakes is that like a mistake in terms of it, if we learn from it, it has a negative impact, and now we know not to do that. Doing it again becomes an error, but until we know, we got to learn, and that's the only way we learn. Yeah. So to embrace those, love it. Chris, thank you so much. Again, Chris Dyer, The Power of Company Culture, How Any Business Can Build a Culture That Improves Productivity, Performance, and Profits. And Chris, final word here as we wrap up. In just a minute or less, for somebody who is listening to all this going, okay, I hear what you're saying. I need to start with transparency. I got to make sure I've got directionality handled. After that, what do you recommend is the next thing? Somebody's looking to transform their culture. Maybe they're leading a 5-person team. Let's take it to that smallest unit, 5 to 7 people. And they're wanting to make progress there. What do you recommend?
I recommend that they think about the pillars that we just talked about. And there's going to be some where they're like, you know, I think we have that. We're okay. We're good. But there's going to be 1 or 2 pillars, hopefully not all 6 more, but like there's going to be 1 or 2 that they're going to be like, we suck at that. My company sucks at that, or my team sucks at that. That's a big problem for us. And I find that if you go after the biggest problem when it comes to culture, and you can go and solve that and make it better, then people are on board with every experiment, everything you want to try going forward. Because when you say, I notice we're really bad at listening, and here's how we fix that, and now we're great listeners, and people feel great, and you're like, okay, we're just okay at positivity, let's try to be better. They're like, yeah, let's do it. I mean, look what we did with listening. Positivity is going to be fantastic. And the mistake that people make is they're like, well, we really suck at listening, but maybe let's go start with positivity and see if we can get a little bit better. Nobody cares about a small change that's a little bit better. They forget it. It just becomes the norm. You need a big win on a big thing. And then people go, oh.
And people are going to feel that win the most if it's that area where the culture is the least. So it's a perfect opportunity.
Right.
All right.
So I think that's where you got to start. So I really appreciate you having me on your podcast. I love the work that you and Karen do. So it's really been fun to be here today.
Well, that's been our pleasure, Chris. I appreciate all your work and culture and giving us and our listeners some practical ways that we can get started on that. Again, Chris Dyer, The Power of Company Culture, How Any Business Can Build a Culture That Improves Productivity, Performance, and Profits. All right, listener, find that place in your culture, whatever unit you've got, your team, your department, or your whole organization, which of those pillars is most lacking, and that's the place to start and make a practical difference and be the leader you'd want your boss to be.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.